Chapter 1 of the Autobiography of Lord Alfred Douglas. This Legamus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. Recording by Rob Marland. Chapter 1. I was born on the 22nd of October 1870 in a house called Ham Hill near Worcester. My father, the 8th Marquess of Queensbury, being at that time master of the Worcestershire Foxhounds, a position he occupied for only 2 years. My father was a fine horseman and devoted to hunting. He was for a short time master of the Dumfriesshire, his native county, Hounds, and this hunt was started by my grandfather, the 7th Marquess, who acted as master for about 10 years. My father was also very fond of riding his own or his friend's horses over jumps, and in his time rode quite a lot of winners. On several occasions he rode in the Grand National on his own horses, but never succeeded in winning the race, though he rode Old Joe, who won in 1886, in a lot of his gallops, and was anxious to ride him in the National itself. Old Joe belonged to his cousin, Arthur Johnston Douglas, of Lockerbie, who bought the horse as a hunter for £150, and hunted him for one season. Arthur Douglas put him in training, and the horse, after winning a race at Sandown, won the Grand National, starting at 40-1. He won on three legs, and pulled up so lame that he was at first believed to have broken down. My father at that time was past his best in the pigskin, and Arthur Douglas wisely put up a professional jockey, Skelton, in preference to my father, who nevertheless was rather sore about having been done out of his chance of riding the winner of the National. Although in his day my father was very well known as a fine cross-country gentleman jockey, and as a bold and fearless rider to hounds, most of his hunting was done from Melton, with the Quorn and Cottesmore, he is chiefly remembered in the sporting world as the author or compiler of the Queensbury Rules of Boxing. I noticed that when he died, in 1899, not a word was written in the sporting papers about his riding record, of which he was far prouder than his boxing. It is astonishing how rapidly memories of that kind disappear. When I was a boy at Winchester, one of my favourite occupations was looking up the old numbers of the Field newspaper, of which there was a bound set in our house library, for records of the races ridden by my father in the 60s and 70s. As a boy I adored my father, and looked up to him as a wonderful man of almost legendary prowess, as a sportsman and a fighter. My intense admiration of my father was doubtless not at all impaired, but on the contrary greatly increased, by the fact that I hardly ever saw him. I am afraid it would be as impossible to say that he was a good father as to say that he was a good husband. He did nothing for us boys. When he saw us he was generally good-natured and kindly, but he never lifted a finger to teach, admonish, or influence us in any direction. It is one of my greatest grievances against him that he never even taught me to ride. I was taught, after a fashion, to ride, by coachmen and grooms, and I had a pony given to me by my father when I was 6 years old. It was called the Rat, and my father paid £60 for it at Tattersall's. It was a rattling good pony, and jumped like a stag. I rode a lot, and later hunted with the Cottesmore from the beautiful place, Burley on the Hill, of my uncle, George Finch, MP, for Rutland. But as a boy I was rather nervous on a horse, and I never really learned to ride properly and with confidence till I did so in a racing stable, my own, at Chantilly, when I was in my 30th year. My father was entirely self-centred. Nay, more, he was utterly selfish, and had been from his early youth used to having his own way about everything. He was in the navy from the age of 12 to about 19, when he succeeded to the title through the tragic death of his father, who shot himself in the park at Kinmount, the family place in Dumfriesshire. Whether my poor grandfather's death was the result of an accident or not is a point which has never been definitely settled. At any rate, he died when my father was a boy, and the destinies of our house declined from that moment with great, one almost might say headlong, rapidity. My father came into a property of about 30,000 acres, and a rent roll of at least £20,000 a year. I don't mean that he had that to spend, but at any rate there was plenty of money. He and my brother Percy, the late Marquis, between them got rid of more than £700,000, and there is nothing left, not an acre in Scotland, not a halfpenny piece from the old property, which was conferred on the elder of his two sons, both illegitimate, by the second Earl of Douglas, himself the head of the male line descended from the original Douglas, the dark grey man, so often referred to by Walter Scott. He had no legitimate issue of his marriage with the daughter of Robert II, King of Scotland. Our direct ancestor, who was killed at the Battle of Otterburn, Chevy Chase, in the year 1388. My father sold the whole property, first the Torthorwald Castle property, and then the Kinmount property. Owing to the quarrel between him and my late brother Percy, no settlement was made, and my brother came into about £300,000 in cash, which was taken off him in the city in a few years, and he died in South Africa in 1920 practically penniless. The unfortunate younger children, including myself, naturally came very badly out of this debacle. We were each left a small sum, less than £15,000, when my father died, and, when the main trunk of our ancient house collapsed, we, the branches, went with it. It is a fairly satisfactory proposition to be the younger son of a marquis who possesses a large landed property, a stable full of horses, a big income, a huge circle of wealthy relatives and friends, and a large crowd of more or less devoted dependents and henchmen. The proposition begins to lose a good deal of its bright colour when the landed property goes, and when all the money goes, it becomes, what it has been to me any time these last 20 years, a particularly appalling kind of purgatory. The lot of a younger son, with the courtesy title of Lord and no money, is indeed a miserable one. I have in my life, for my sins, been through every kind of suffering, ranging from mere acute unpleasantness to the most awful mental agony. But I believe the most constant cross I have had to bear is precisely that of having been born, and having had to go on all my life being, a lord without money. From more than 1,000 years of ancestors I have inherited all the instincts of the true aristocrat, the chief of which I take to be the instinct to be generous and open-handed, and to be the helper and defender of the poor or oppressed. To see people all round who want helping, and not to be able to help them, to be obliged to refuse when appealed to, is a constant and perennial misery. Whenever I have had money, I have always given it away to anyone who wanted it or asked for it, and it has generally been a case of first come, first served. That is to say, whoever happened to ask for it first, or most persistently, got it. When I have had no money to give, I have given anything else I could produce, or be the equivalent for. I have never, as far as I know, refused to take on anything to help either an individual, or simply the human race, or my fellow countrymen. My motto has always been, give, give, give. It has been the passion of my life to sacrifice myself for others, to find and fight for lost causes, which I never believe to be really lost, to affront unimaginable odds, and never to admit that I was beaten, even when I found myself, as I ultimately did, in prison. I am now in a sort of backwater of life, and I am able to look back and see my own career as if it were the career of someone else. I have analysed myself and the motive springs of my actions, and I have discovered what I have just set down about myself. I certainly do not set it down by way of self-glorification. Probably I might have been much more useful to my family and friends, and to society at large, if I had merely tried to get on in the world, and to make friends with the mammon of unrighteousness. I am now merely recording facts. Whatever I have done in life has been done in obedience to an overpowering instinct. Anyone who reads my poetry with insight and intelligence will see in it all that I have said here about myself. While I, necessarily, believe in free will, I believe also in the influence of heredity. A man cannot help his instincts and the natural tendencies he is born with, but he can control and direct them. I believe I inherited my desire to help from my mother, who was, and is, the antithesis of my father in character. My mother has always lived for others, and has reduced herself to poverty by her generosity and her inability to refuse assistance to anyone who appealed to her. It is an interesting fact that my mother, who on her father's, the late Mr. Alfred Montgomery, side, comes from the Scottish Montgomerys of Eglinton, a princely Norman family nearly as old in Scotland as the Douglas family. On her mother's side can trace her descent back to Jocelyn, the 13th and last Earl of Northumberland. Thus, when my father married my mother, the direct descendant in the male line of the Douglas killed at Chevy Chase married a descendant of the Percy who was taken prisoner by the Douglases at the same historic battle. Consequently, I combine in my own veins the blood of the two greatest houses of Scotland and England. Obviously, then, I am quite as well born as anyone now living in Great Britain, and I must ask my readers to remember this when judging my actions and my methods of looking at life. I have always had the utmost contempt for public opinion. I began by despising it from what one might call, and what my critics, notably Frank Harris in his Life and Confessions of Oscar Wilde, have called it, aristocratic insolence. When I had had the aristocratic insolence knocked out of me by a succession of hammer blows from fate, I still went on despising public opinion from the point of view of religion, which, rightly considered, is in itself the most aristocratic thing in the world. When I became a Catholic, I don't mean an Anglo-Catholic, but a real Roman Catholic, in my 41st year, I was uplifted and delighted to find that Catholics are taught to pray to be delivered from the respect of persons. I have never had the slightest respect of persons, and it was a great encouragement to find that I had got by nature what numbers of people are not able to attain even by praying for it. Respect of persons, of course, means respecting persons for reasons other than their virtues. For instance, to respect a judge or a duke or a king, simply because he is a judge or a duke or a king, and without reference to his character, is quite unchristian and quite unaristocratic. Conversely, to despise a man simply because he is poor or unfortunate or unpopular is equally unchristian and equally unaristocratic. End of chapter 1.